This is a Dionysos divine wine, drunkenness, who represents the dynamic of the unconscious. From below consciousness, he comes singing forth. And the wonderful thing in the Greek world is they are in accord. Dionysos is admitted to Olympus. So the Dionysian shatters. Dionysos is the energy that shatters in order to bring forth. Anything that is going to be created involves the shattering of what was there before it. It's what the Christ came down into the world for the shattering, for the shattering, the shattering. This beautiful Maenad, snakes in her hair, gonna tear a leopard apart. With the thyrsos here, symbolic of the sap, the vegetable flow of life, uncontrolled by reason, just the dynamic of nature. Here is Orpheus torn apart, as Jesus was torn apart in the scourging and crucifixion. The eternity is in love with the forms of time. But to come into those forms, it has to be dismembered. And then you, as a separate entity in the form of time, in order to lose your commitment to this little instance, you must be dismembered and opened to the transcendent. Orpheus, Bacchus, crucified. And he goes to the cross like a bridegroom to the bride. And you have the death and resurrection motif of the moon. All you have to do is spend a little while with these things. And they sing to you. I'll never forget the experience of going to Delphi in Greece. The temples have all been deliberately smashed by the vandalism of the Christians. But they're still there, and you can see what the Greek idea of corporal beauty was. There is then the oracle, where the Pythoness, the prophetess, received the inspiration from the fumes, the smoke coming up from the abyss, and prophesied and gave statements of destiny. And then you have up on another level this beautiful theater with the whole wonderful valley and landscape as its backdrop. And that accord with nature, and the bringing of nature to its high fulfillment in human nature. This is Greek. It's this idea of the individual and the individual quest. And of course, the great symbolic moment in the Greeks' own understanding of this matter was the great battle of Troy. Marathon, where the Persian slave civilization, you might say, they had conquered everything in Asia, from the Ionian Isles to the Indus River, including all the world of the ancients, Mesopotamia, Egypt, and all. And the Greeks stopped them. A few years later, Alexander the Great goes smashing through the whole Persian Empire, a young man in his early 20s. With the idea of a self-directed, not overmastered field of action. But here we have the two traditions in Europe. One, you might say, the heroic one, which is the native one of Europe, going back to the old Germanic, Celtic spirit, and then the applied Christian one, which is brought in from the Near East. By the 11th and 12th centuries, Europe is beginning to assimilate this material. And the Grail story, the Arthurian romances, represent this assimilation. The theme of the Grail is the bringing of life into what is known as the wasteland. The wasteland is the preliminary theme to which the Grail is the answer. What is the sense of the wasteland? It's the world of people living inauthentic lives. If there is a path, it is someone else's path, and you are not on the adventure. Each entered the forest at a point that he himself had chosen, where it was darkest and there was no path. Now, who can see and enter the castle of the Grail? Not everybody. Only those with a spiritual readiness for the experience. The sword represents the virtue. The sword represents the energy. It has come to Arthur from the abyss. This is the world of the unconscious, the world of the gods, the goddess who informs all things. Arthur, Artehe, was revered as a god. He's originally a Celtic god. And the name Artus, Arthur, is related to Artemis, Arcturus. All of these are related to the deity, the bear. And the bear is the oldest worshipped deity in the world. We have bear shrines going back to Neanderthal times in just this part of the world from perhaps 100,000 BC. The fantastic tradition and the levels and levels of culture that have piled up in Europe, which is the, not the youngest, it's the oldest culture in the world. The Celts come into Europe in the first millennium BC. They come from Bavaria, across France, Switzerland, and into the British Isles. Now, the people who had been in Europe before were pre-Celtic, pre-Indo-European. And their tradition may go back all the way to the caves. But the great period of their flowering is that of Stonehenge. Now Merlin, he's associated with Druid mysteries. The Druids were the priests and spiritual guardians of the Celts. There are certain places geographically, when you go to them, you can see why these have magic mystery traditions associated with them. There's something in the land. So the tradition of Glastonbury, which is associated with the Grail Castle, is associated also way, way back with this 1500 BC period. This is a magical place. Here you have a statement right on earth that illustrates and allows you to experience the relationship of lunar cycles to solar cycles. So it becomes a sacred place. And every sacred place is the place where eternity shines through time. The whole mystery of mythology, which is that of seeing through the forms of time, the radiance of eternity in your own life and in the forms around you. The whole mystery is that, you might say, of the metaphor. Very deep is the well of the past. Should we not call it bottomless? And as one who has tried himself to go back to the origins of mythic forms, I can see this. It is bottomless. The mythological themes don't have a beginning. They have the archetypes, the elementary ideas. And so where is paradise? Where do they come from? They come from die Seele, the soul. The origin is the soul of man. It is though the whole universe were a dream, dreamed by a single dreamer, in which all the dream characters dream too. And so all these dreams interlock. Well, this is an idea that comes up in India in what is known as the net of Indra. The universe is, as it were, a net of gems in which, in all the junctures of the net, at each of these, there is a jewel. And each of the jewels reflects all the others. That's this idea of we're all particles of this great cycling dream. And one of the great Hindu images of the world dream is a Vishnu dreaming the universe. We are all parts of Vishnu's dream. Now in the Indian pictures, we see the world dream coming from Vishnu in the form of a lotus growing from his navel. The lotus spray. The lotus is Padma, a goddess. Lakshmi Padma, the goddess lotus and good fortune. That recitation from Tibet, Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani, the jewel of illumination, Padme, is in the lotus. It's right in the lotus of the world that illumination resides. The illumination means you're letting go of ego. Gone, gone, gone to the undershore, landed on the undershore, illumination, hallelujah. Pragyaparamita, the wisdom of the Andashok. But what she's doing is bringing the two hands together, the hand of earthly experience, the hand of spiritual rapture. She's at that point. And that's the wisdom of the Andashaw, beyond pairs of opposites. The one who's trying to get away from life to nirvana is still caught in pairs of opposites. But when you get there, you realize, this is it, right now. This is the favorite Buddha of the East. This is Amida, Sanskrit Amitabha. Amita means immeasurable, bha is radiance. The Buddha of immeasurable radiance. Now, there's a legend associated with his name. When he was on the very threshold of illumination, he made a vow. He said, I will not accept illumination for myself unless through my illumination I can bring to illumination and release all beings. And so, when he achieved illumination, there broke out before him a great lake. And it was a lake of bliss. And on this lake were lotuses. And anyone who during his lifetime paid devotion to Amida would not be committed to another lifetime, but would be reborn on a lotus in Amida's lotus pond, called Sukhavati, the place of bliss. If the person was not even nearly illuminated, his lotus would be closed. He'd be in a closed lotus. And he'd be floating on this lake, which would be the water of the five colors, of the five elements. As the waters rippled, he would hear. All is impermanent, all is without a self. All is impermanent, all is without a self. Around the lake would be these jewel trees with jewel birds singing, and they would be singing, all is impermanent, all is without a self. Musical instruments in the air would be playing, all is impermanent, all is without a self. Presently, he'd get the message. Meanwhile, the radiance of the Buddha himself, like a setting sun on the western horizon, would be penetrating the petals, and they would open. And there he would be sitting as a Buddha in meditation, floating on the lotus pond. And presently, in his meditation, he would dissolve into a rapture and transcendence. Now, the quality of this Buddha is mercy, compassion. This is the Buddha whose lieutenant is Avalokiteshvara and whose incarnation on earth then is in the Dalai Lama. And he is the Bodhisattva of infinite compassion. The Bodhisattva willingly comes back to the world. Joyful participation in the sorrows of the world. And his accent always in his talk about Buddhism is on the force of compassion and mercy and love. There was preserved in Tibet the Buddhist forms of the highest, most sophisticated tantric development. Now, the mythology of death and birth is of reincarnation. Between the moment of death and the moment of reconception, 49 days pass. 7 times 7 days. And during the course of this, one has gone through all the worlds of the chakras. The notion is that at the moment of death, you experience the great light. Can you stand it? Have you prepared yourself to dissolve? You may speak of it as the void. You may speak of it as the abyss. You may speak of it as Mother Light. It is that which transcends all cogitations. There are no words for it. So at the moment of death, the Lama will say, you are now experiencing the Mother Light. Between your consciousness and universal consciousness, no obstruction. And the Lama will say, do not be afraid. These powers that are tearing you apart and all that, they're just figments of your own imagination. They are, in the field of time, figments. There's nothing to lose. There's nothing to do. Hold the still point. Still point without moving. You've lost it. And when you lost it, great cliffs close behind you, and the upper regions are lost to you. And the Lama will be telling you where you are on the way down and what to hold to and to try to do it. And here you are disintegrating, trying to have this realization that will release you from another birth. Now, are you going to identify with the body, the vehicle, or are you going to identify with the light? The ultimate source is undifferentiated consciousness. An individual life represents a knot of delusions. There are a lot of things you think are important, and that's what you're living for. And if you die before you've learned that they're not important, you're going to be born again. And it's the dissolution, the breaking of that knot, that is intended. Anatman, there is no soul. But there is a soul as long as you're living. Do you understand what I mean? The goal is to get rid of that thing, to dissolve like the dewdrop into the sea. When we come to the Indian mythology, which carries right into the present the implications of the old Bronze Age, we find that a cycle of time endures for 432,000 years. This is the Yuga. And then you get up to the Maha Yuga, the great Yuga or cycle within which the other cycles proceed, and you get 4,320,000. If you add them up, they come out to 9. This is the great number of the goddess. She is time. She is the womb. 9 is the grain, you might say, of her movement. Here she is as black time. And here is her prime altar, the battlefield. Sacrifice. Kali dancing at the burning ground. In her hand is the head of Brahma. That's the creator of the world. We're going past that and all its values. She cuts off her own head to release you from her bondage. That's the burning ground, and she releasing us all. So we have the big cycles of time, and we have the biblical tradition, and all right out of this Bronze Age, which has to have been based on actual observation. It's the rhythm of our own heartbeat. It's the rhythm of the universe. We are in accord with the universal rhythm. I want to move to Southeast Europe, 7,000 to 3,500 BC. This is very, very early stuff. And it's a period when the mother goddess is dominant. She is bird goddess, spiritual goddess. Associated with her is the boar. Here is a pig goddess. And the labyrinth. Ceramic serpent, all of the same order. Here's the whole mythology in a cluster in front of us here. This little Venus of Lozelle is holding in her hand, in her right hand, elevated, a bison horn with 13 vertical strokes. That's the number of nights between the first crescent and the full moon. The other hand is on the belly. What is suggested is a recognition of the equivalence of the menstrual and the lunar cycles. This would be the first inkling we have of a recognition of counterparts between the celestial and earthly rhythms of life. Just as in the woman's body, the womb is celebrated, the cave in which we are have been wandering is the womb of the mother goddess. I tell you, when you go into those caves, very interesting psychological transformation takes place automatically. This is the place. The world of the light above is quite secondary. And these animals that you see are the animal germs, you might say, the Platonic ideas of the herds that are being invoked. This is where it comes from, in this germinating ground. In the beginning, the animal and human forms are mixed, just as they were in the early dancer at Trois Frères. Now the stag loses its antlers annually and brings them back again, and so is, as it were, an incarnation of the forest spirit. And the shaman is the one who can invoke the animals. Mythology is a production of the wisdom body, not of the intellect. It is not. The white man has ideas, the Indian has visions. And visions come from a deeper, more mysterious center. This wonderful Oglala Sioux medicine man, Black Elk, who was the keeper of the sacred pipe and so forth, and had an incredibly beautiful vision. And when he was a boy of 9, that's the shamanic vision that converted him, you might say, into a man of mystery and power. Well, he said that in the course of that vision, he saw himself on the central mountain of the universe, the highest mountain of them all. And the highest mountain was Harney Peak in South Dakota. And immediately after that, he said, the central mountain is everywhere. Chief Seattle, will you teach your children what we have taught our children, that the earth is our mother? What befalls the earth befalls all the sons of the earth. This we know, the earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected like the blood that unites us all. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. One thing we know, our God is also your God. The earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. Your destiny is a mystery to us. What will happen when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the wild horses tamed? What will happen when the secret corners of the forest are heavy with the scent of many men and the view of the ripe hills is blotted by talking wires? Where will the thicket be? Gone. Where will the eagle be? Gone. And what is it to say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt, the end of living and the beginning of survival? It's natural to life that life should be dangerous. And now it's dangerous for the planet. Formerly it was dangerous for this society, that society, or another. Just think of the Spaniards arrived and wiped out all the people in the Caribbean Sea within 2 generations. There were no more natives there. Then they wipe out 2 civilizations, 500 men wipe out 2 civilizations. The world has been experiencing absolute disaster. We've been so protected that we don't realize that. And now the fear of something blowing up. You see what I mean? Indra's. Brahma's eyes opening and closing. And, okay, I heard one man say, there's no necessity that the human race should survive. Chief Seattle, in another of his words, said, why should I lament the disappearance of my people? All things die. The white race will find this out too. So yield to what is coming. We're in a free fall into future. We don't know where we're going. Things are changing so fast. And always, when you're going through a long tunnel, anxiety comes along. And all you have to do to transform your hell into a paradise is to turn your fall into a voluntary act. I mean, it's a very interesting shift of perspective, and that's all it is. Joyful participation in the sorrows, and everything changes. Life throws up around us these temptations. these distractions. And the problem is to find the immovable center, and you can survive anything. And the myths will help you to do that. And this is the quest for the inner life that will enable you to float down the stream like a human being instead of just some babbit or robot in the hands of a political institution. And that's what I'm interested in bringing forward here. And I may not be changing the world, but I'm changing people. And that's what's necessary. That's what's got to be done. Finally, after this stage of experiences, which we have all had, the person has gone past his personal life into the life of transpersonal experiences, one comes to suddenly a stage of understanding it all. You can't talk about it, it's just the rapture of seeing and knowing what it's all about, and that it's good, and that it's great, and for all the pains and all that, nevertheless, it is as it is, and it is a marvel. And the pains and the pleasures are not the ends you live for, but just the rapture of this beholding. And finally, there's one stage still further beyond this one of symbolic rapture. It's that of a kind of metaphysical sense that you have struck the ground and you have found the root of being.